Okay. All right. So hang on a second. Now I'm going to stop the recording. Just
okay.
Hello. Thrasher here. Thrasher's Wheat Radio special edition. Neil Young's 70th birthday coming up November the 12th. And with us today, we have with us the author of a new Neil Young book, Harvey Kubernick, who has just published a book titled Neil Young, Heart of Gold. And we're going to talk to Harvey here. How you doing, Harvey?
Fine. How you doing, man?
Great, great. You're out in Los Angeles.
I sure am.
All right. Well, great. Well, we're glad to have you. For those of you who may have seen on our blog information about this new book, Harvey's a longtime music journalist, has written a number of books over the years. He's most recently, or one of the books that he's written in particular that folks are interested in, was one called Canyon of Dreams, The Magic and Music of Laurel Canyon. So that's got a little bit of some Neil stuff in there, but that whole era of time was certainly a big time in music out west, out there in L.A. So, Harvey, we're really glad to have you here with us today to talk about your book and talk about how this is all came together. It's a beautiful book and very nicely printed, nice paper and nice photos in it and great stories. Can you tell us a little bit more about how this whole project came about?
You know, it's actually one of the few times where a book packager and publisher in England emailed me and asked me, would you like to do a book on Neil Young? Part of it was I had done a book with them on Leonard Cohen a couple of years ago. I don't know why I'm drawn to Canadians, but they're very happy with that, and that's a very successful book. And asked me if I'd like to do a Neil Young book, and I really didn't have to do, as it was in the past, and I'm going back a bunch of years, any kind of super book proposal or tons of sample chapters and present 50 or 100 photos and do the whole dance of presentation. I mean, my reputation sort of is maybe speaking for myself. And they also thought a book on Neil was in order, partially to coincide and to be published, and tying in, for lack of a better word, with his 70th birthday. It wasn't the exclusive goal to tie it in or, you know, with a new record, with Willie's Kids or Archives Volume 2 that might be imminent, or I'm sure one of Neil's, single or double live albums, with one of the bands he has in his library. Those factors seem to kind of arrive anyways, because Neil Young is an artist that puts out a steady flow of work. So
sure.
The offer was made, would you like to do the book? And I was into it simply because I had been listening to some Neil Young at the time. I said to myself, well, actually, I'd interviewed Graham Nash for a magazine, a Record Collector News magazine, just before the release of that box set, CSNY, 1974. And Graham is always very gracious as an interview subject. And I had really been kind of buzzed from the interview I had with Graham, and lots of it was about Neil or recording with Neil, meeting Neil, and touring with Neil. So then the email came literally, about the Neil Young book, and then I said to myself, wow, I've been present at some pretty pivotal moments in Neil Young's journey. Now, every day is a pivotal moment for all of us, but if we're talking about a touring, performing artist, I said to myself, because of the Laurel Canyon book especially, I don't think a week goes by where some record collector in a record store or some girl in the market or somebody in a library, or of course at some music shows, especially if it's, somebody who's in maybe the classic rock category, where somebody says to me, did you ever see the Buffalo Springfield? It's kind of become second to, I never saw the Beatles, that kind of deal. And right. I would always say, well, yeah, I saw them twice. They were like my favorite LA band, you know, just under maybe the Doors and the Byrds and the Beach Boys. But, well, yeah, and I realized, well, I saw the Springfield twice, and I did see the Dorothy Chandler, Neil Young 1971 acoustic show. And then I said to myself, wow, I was like in the front row at the last waltz. And, you know, I've met Neil a few times at various restaurants years and years ago around town or once at a studio. And I realized, wow, I've recorded at Gold Star Studio. He did the first Buffalo Springfield album there, and some of those demos end up in the Buffalo Springfield, you know, box set. And he, for years, he had his records kind of mastered at Gold Star or lacquered there. And I said, you know, I have some interesting, you know, personal history here, which is partially me and partially Neil being available touring, that this could be a very interesting book if I could do it my way. And luckily, you know, the people that I work with doing the book, they didn't say to me, you know, there's too many engineers in this book. You're making it too technical. Why are you speaking to the bass player so much? Who's Don Randy? You know, none of those things came up because I realized I was bringing in some pretty interesting, what's funny, Graham Nash and I joke about a phrase that I coined that's a chapter of the Laurel Canyon book. It's called reissue tissue. You like that term?
Reissue tissue.
That's my term. I'm going to do the T-shirt on that one. So I have got some very good reissue tissue that no one has ever read or heard about because I happen to be there. And also part of it is the dynamics and the equation that I'm born in Los Angeles, that I went to high school in West Hollywood, that I learned to drive, driver's ed class was in Laurel Canyon. So there are a couple of native rights that I think feed into this book, and I think all of us, and I'm talking about the readers and the guy who did it, me, I think we kind of share and benefit because I'm not offering revisionist history on Neil. I'm not a Wikipedia child. I just happen to be there to see a few of the pivotal moments that I think, you know, really inform the book.
Well, I think that's great, Harvey, and I think a lot of that does come across in the book, and the fact that, you know, what you just mentioned about having seen the Buffalo Springfield twice, I guess that's Hollywood, Whiskey a Go-Go. I mean, you know,
Hollywood Bowl, in 1967, 1966, the Santa Monica Civic Auditorium, literally the debut of Steve Stills announcing the new song For What It's Worth.
Ah, wow.
And they were, it's funny, they're both radio shows. The Santa Monica Civic show, a 3,000-seater, was a KBLA radio, AM radio station event. And the KHJ one was an April 67, you know, a group show with Johnny Rivers and Brenda Holloway and the Supremes and the Seeds. And was it, what struck me about the Buffalo Springfield that night, and I know there's a tape somewhere, it's on the Internet and all that. I don't have time to live on the Internet and do all this stuff, or I'd never get any books done, you know. But that being said, I will always remember my brother and I went with my brother and we were talking about it recently. Buffalo Springfield played a very early set that night, and KHJ had been very nice to the Buffalo Springfield, sort of debuting For What It's Worth, and you know, Clancy and all that. It was kind of the RKO, you know, station in town, AM radio. And I always remember that they did their set, and it was, you know, I'm like a teenager at the time, and it was really loud and good and quick. And then Steve announced, thank you very much, we're hopping on a flight to go up to San Francisco to play, you know, at the Fillmore, a club, you know, we're going to go to play San Francisco later on tonight. And maybe they ended up going to nearby Burbank Airport and going to San Francisco and playing at, you know, 11:30 or midnight or something, you know, and for Bill Graham. And I thought those guys had a lot of, I didn't know the word work ethic then. I did not know that term, but I said, boy, these people are really determined to do two shows in one night in two different cities.
Yeah, that is.
I mean, you know, so I was kind of taking notes and all that kind of stuff, too. But
well,
what I liked about the...
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm glad you were there and able to, you know, bring it to us here in 2015.
And listen, I was a big fan of John Einerson's book on the Buffalo Springfield and his work with Neil Young. I really like his stuff a lot. And he wrote a really good book on the Buffalo Springfield. But because he was, you know, in Canada and had never seen the band, I provided some of that info to him, and it really resonated to him. And I said, well, I'll just mention it in the intro of my book, or since I saw the Springfield, maybe the rabbit hole will bring me to some really interesting people who saw them as well. I mean, I got so locked into the Buffalo Springfield in doing this book, and it was just a very small part of the book. As you know, I was doing a 70-year look at Neil Young, not just 1966 to 67 in Hollywood Laurel Canyon before he splits to Topanga Canyon. But I was able to find three different people who offered me remarks on the Farewell Springfield concert in 1968. And I don't think we see that in any other books on Neil Young, or it's ever discussed where you find the witnesses to the, and it's the one show I missed. I had some after school, high school job, and I just couldn't go out to Long Beach. I didn't drive at the time. I didn't have a car. I'm not lamenting it, but I, over the years, being Harvey Kubernick, I meet all the people I want to meet. And so there was a place for me to ask Rodney Bingenheimer, tell me about the last Springfield show, since he went to a lot of the sessions of their albums. And I said to Denny Bruce, tell me about the last Springfield show, since you lived with Neil for a while and you knew him. And you went in the limo back from the show with him and Jack Nietzsche. And then I asked Mark Guerrero, who was a big Springfield fan, who attended the show with Rick Rosas, his longtime buddy.
Well, yeah, the late great.
Thank you. Who I knew, who's in my Laurel Canyon book. And so I always had these little bits of pieces of information, and they fit very logically into this book on Neil.
All right. Well, yeah, there's a lot of ground covered in the book. Certainly, you know, 40, 45 years, we're not going to be able to kind of cover it all here in our interview here. But, Harvey, I just want to ask you, you know, you've mentioned a number of different anecdotes and stories and players, you know, in Neil's career here so far. But can you just, you know, pick out maybe, you know, a few items, an item or two of you know, something that you learned that you didn't know about Neil Young during the course of this research, or something that, you know, you mentioned that we would only find within your book, Heart of Gold?
There's a lot of them.
Anything come to mind?
I learned a lot talking to a guy named Denny Bruce, who was kind of in the prototype Mothers of Invention and knew Neil and was a very close friend of Jack Nietzsche. And you know, it was Denny who went up to Neil's sort of place in Laurel Canyon and heard Neil playing the 12-string guitar, sort of playing him portions of Expecting the Fly. And it was Denny that said to Jack Nietzsche, because initially Denny was up there to hear songs for the Everly Brothers that Jack was going to go work with.
He was one of Neil's early producers before David Briggs, but
yes,
certainly a very
arranger, keyboardist, you know,
right.
Seminal part in the launch of Neil Young as a solo artist, and also worked with the Springfield, you know, the second album and all that. And it's interesting because the origin of that song might have ended up on an Everly Brothers record, but both Jack and Denny said, no, this is something you need to do. And I think the book shows the migration of Expecting to Fly, because I bring people into the studio of it. I talked to Don Randy, the keyboardist, on Expecting to Fly, and he's also on Broken Arrow. And so I get some of the engineers or the keyboardists like Don Randy to tell me about playing on Expecting the Fly or the long piano thing on Broken Arrow. And he said to me, Neil's songs are like movie scripts.
Oh, yeah,
and I thought that was pretty interesting. And And then in the book, Don explains Neil knew what he wanted to do and how to get it, and he knew how to bring people in. And that's been a reoccurring theme with Neil Young. If he wants to make an album or wants to go on tour, he gets the people he wants, whether it be Spooner or you name them, or Keltner, or I have to say Jim Keltner. And, you know, Don pointed out to me Neil was able to do that once he, you know, split from the Springfield. It was kind of his ball game. And then Graham Nash is always a very interesting subject. It didn't make the book due to word count, and because I had 6,000-7,000 words just with Graham Nash, and I had to condense it. But we did talk about the 1974 tour, and I said to Graham,
you mentioned a couple of things about the 74 tour.
Yeah, which I thought were really interesting. When I did a big interview with Graham for Record Collector News magazine like a year and a half ago, it was to coincide with that 74 box set.
Right.
And I wasn't asking him about Neil Young, thinking I'm going to do a book on Neil Young one day. It's just Graham was a fan of Expecting the Fly. When he was in England, he had heard it, and it was a big talk of the town over in London. And he's an unabashed Neil Young fan. He's quite always candid about Neil Young, which is the best thing about him. I mean, if you've read Graham's interviews or read his books, he just tells you he lives pretty unfiltered, and he's a pretty honest guy. That being said, I said, well, how much of a Neil Young fan were you, considering you were you're rehearsing at Neil Young's ranch for the 74 tour? You have to do, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash material. You have to do Deja Vu material. Is it one of those things like when, and by the way, I also saw CS, I should mention this, not for my street cred, but, you know, I did see the debut of Crosby, Stills, and Nash Young at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles in 1969. Okay, so I've been there for the pivotal moments of some Neil things. I just happened to be playing Los Angeles. I went to the show. I wasn't a writer then. I went to rock and roll concerts. That was a really great show because at the time I had seen, you know, a lot of Motown music and stuff in the Greek Theater, and rock and roll acts hadn't been there too often. But what was interesting about that show and probably the 1970 tour is I remember, like, you know, everyone in Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young would play Deja Vu music or, you know, Wooden Ships or you name it or Long Time Gone. But they'd each do one or two solo things where Graham did King Midas in reverse or Neil did The Loner. And, you know, Steve Stills would do Black Queen, you know, and Crosby would do Triad or something like that. So I would say to Neil, I said to Graham, in 74, I mean, how did the repertoire come together? He said, well, we all made suggestions. And I said, well, did you suggest some deep catalog items for Neil to do? And he said, are you kidding? I wanted to do Expecting the Fly. And Neil said, nah, you couldn't sing that. And Graham said, I don't want to use profanity here, but Graham said, if I'm going to make that suggestion, you better believe I can sing that tune. And I said, did you offer any other suggestions? And I'm talking about specific Neil tunes for the live set. And he said, offer, Harvey. I wanted to kick off the tour with When You Dance from After the Gold Rush.
Now, that would have been
that kind of stuff floored me.
Yeah, now that's interesting. And
I mean, he's you know, I'm just saying, these are the kind of little things I get. But part of it is, it's my own. I mean, this comes from knowing and working with and recording the UCLA basketball coach, John R. Wooden, who always said, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And so I work very hard on these things, and then the results sometimes are finding things out from Graham Nash, because I don't think I've ever heard him attempting to do Expecting the Fly or When You Dance from the Gold Rush album. And I kind of thought, hey, that's kind of cool. I'll put it in the book, or, you know, things like that. So those are the little nuggets that I enjoy, you know, in the journey that I do.
Yeah, no, those are good nuggets. And, you know, certainly Expecting the Fly, you mentioned the song, you know, that's a complicated song, and to try and pull that off in concert would have been something
yes.
else. So anyway, these are all great stories in Harvey's new book here, Heart of Gold, that we're talking about here, Thrasher Suite Radio. And we do have a contest running on the blog, and we'll for some free copies from the publisher. We'll talk about that at the back end a little bit, and details are on the blog. But maybe we'll just move into not necessarily wrapping it up, but maybe hitting a couple other things here before we let you go. You did mention that you had done a lot of research here with musicians, producers, engineers, and whatnot. But you also talked to some of our rusty friends like Sherry Wilson or John Einerson. And I don't know if you want to talk about any kinds of things.
I mean,
and who you ran into, or
there was one. I would never use the word obstacle because I had many years ago been interviewed by John Einerson for his book on Arthur Lee and love. I mean, he came to my apartment. I'm going back many years. And so I know where to find the people, but I was looking for some, so I've never been to Canada. And I said, okay, if I'm going to do this Neil Young book, I can go to Canada. And, and I can go on the internet and I can, set Neil Young up in Canada and then start focusing on, his record deals out here, with the Springfield and all that, even though, of course, he did some, independent things on 45 and stuff, out of Toronto or Winnipeg or whatever. But I was, I became aware of Sherry Wilson's book that was sent to me.
That's the young Neil
and that's
book
one book
early years.
And I was really knocked out by her research and writing, and I said to myself, well, I could either use some quotes, attribute them to her, and it's cool. And by the way, I have a relationship with Canada simply because I think since 1974, I've interviewed Burton Cummings of the Guess Who 6 or 10 times in 45 years.
Wow.
We've talked about Neil Young. Well, considering Burton's band, the Guess Who, Randy and Burton's band, covered Flying on the Ground is Wrong, which is a reoccurring tune in this book as well. Flying on the Ground is Wrong. It's littered throughout the book if you really want to see some of the foreshadowing aspects of the writing I do. But I understood Winnipeg at least through Burton Cummings talking to me. I understood Winnipeg at least a little bit through Lauren Safier, Burton's longtime manager for 50 years, talking to me. And I'm talking socially at parties and interviewing Burton or writing record company bios for him over the years. And I'm going back, when he had hits with Stand Tall or Break It To Him Gently. You know what I'm talking about. So I Canada was not, but I was also aware of all the Canadians that moved here, like Leonard Cohen and Burton and Neil to here, or at least to Northern California. So I knew the migration of all these characters must have really wanted to leave all the snow and come to my wonderful sunshine. That being said, Sherry's book, very instrumental in me at least understanding Neil Young, Neil's mother, Scott Young, Neil's prolific father. And I just said, I need to interview this Sherry Wilson at length. And one of the joys of the books I do, and this is up for the audience and yourself to go yes or no on this, I employ the multi-voice interview neo-narrative style. I can write all these books myself as Harvey Kubernick and go A to Z and do it all. I have chosen to weave in a lot of other voices and people and give them a forum and plug their own products, and also they have slightly a better understanding of the geography I do, especially the Canadian voices or the musicians that have played with Neil. And I think you probably enjoy seeing 50 other people quoted at length in these books. There's something about bringing in a whole team to these kind of books. So Sherry and I developed an email and a phone relationship, and I interviewed her at length, and then she recommended a couple other people that are rusty people, to be involved in the book on some specific things. And then I thought it was very important that I track down Larry LeBlanc, a legendary Canadian writer, because he was at, you know, the Massey Hall show, and you know, like Sherry was. And, you know, and then he recommended I speak to a guy named Peter Goddard about Neil, you know, who he caught, like, the riverboat shows, you know, Neil's solo stuff. And then I, through Roger Steffens, a fantastic author, journalist, broadcaster, reggae scholar, Roger and I have a telepathic relationship, and he said, Harvey, Richie York is coming to my house for dinner. You need to meet him. You just did a Leonard Cohen book, and, you know, I heard Van Morrison playing at your apartment, Moon Dance, and Richie and Van Morrison are friends for decades. And if you ever do a Neil Young book or something, he did early interviews with Neil in Canada, and he saw the early club shows when he wrote for one of the Toronto newspapers. And I said, I'll see you for dinner. So I went to dinner, and Richie and I have developed a personal and email correspondence, and he is a seminal figure in rock journalism. And he went deep into his vaults for me in Australia in his storage locker. I love Australians. And he said to me, you know, my wife and I, Minnie, have found something in our storage lockers that I haven't really looked at in 40 years, but can I give you some quotes from an interview I did with Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young in 1969 that was released as a promotional album, like something like Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young Rap or something, you know? It was a promotional interview album kind of done coinciding with Deja Vu. And I've never seen the item, but Richie gave me a handful of quotes from each voice, meaning Crosby, Stills, and Neil, unpublished from, you know, late 69, post-Woodstock, you know, that end up in the book. And now I've, you know, Richie is in my Leonard Cohen book, and Richie's in this book, and I've helped Richie on his brand new book on, you know, John Lennon and Yoko Ono. And so all these things, because we're all fans of the music and we serve the music, I know it may sound corny, but because we are in service of the music, all these little roads and secret tunnels all get connected. And it's Harvey Kubernick with the flashlight that goes down the tunnel and shows it all, you know?
Yeah, no, it's not corny. And you mentioned that CSNY rap. It sounds like something.
Wait a second. Have you ever heard of that?
No. I think it's something we need to track down.
Yeah, but anyways, he had one in storage because he did the interview as a college radio promotional album.
Well, we'll just have to get.
So how about
the ball.
That one? So I was able to unearth some of those quotes, you know, with full citation to Richie, and I think that kind of empowers the book because I really went deep digging on this one, let me tell you.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, there's some, you know, some photos in here, like you've got a David Briggs and Neil Young photo that I've never seen before, and as well as a number of others, and all the photos.
And again, I will say about
quality.
the photo and visual artifacts, I'm not the photo editor per se, I work closely, but I would say I originated, birthed, discovered, and found many, many photos in the book, or provided the contacts of the rights holders. But I also have the luxury of, you know, working a lot with the Henry Diltz photo studio and getting scans done there. And you have a
significant amount of credits and acknowledgments there at the back of the book.
Well, because many people went into their archives for me, from fans who had, like, ticket stubs to my own stuff to... if I didn't have the posters of some seminal events, John Van Hammersfeld did, of the Pinnacle Dance Concert at the Shrine Auditorium, a show in November 1967, or, you know, I would say there's only maybe one or two or three album covers. I mean, of course I had to run the Stampede album cover. I'm sure your people appreciate that. But it wasn't going to be one of those books where you just run album covers and generic stock promotional photos, and I think one of the One of the strong points of the book, of course, we're seeing Neil Young in color, and the pictures just aren't black and white photos stuck in the middle of the book or sprinkled into the book like many other books. There's actually not only color photos and rare artifacts and unseen items, but I was very diligent of getting the best scans made when I was involved, and or the book editor, the book photo editor, acquiring the best scans, meaning the best reproductions of the pictures. And I think due to the paper stock and, shall we say, the large book format, kind of coffee table-ish, if you know what I mean, I think those pictures just leap off the page. And even though people have seen a bunch of them before, you haven't seen them like this.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah, no, it's a very quality printing, and you know, speaking of which, you know, one of the things that you do have throughout the book is these timelines where you take years and different events.
Yes,
and I'm sure that was probably interesting trying to figure out how to
map
all that out.
The initial timelines were presented to me, and then I beefed and bulked them up and added some stuff and subtracted some stuff, or fixed some dates, or they caught some dates that I was off base on in, you know, production. And the timeline thing is this kind of this shadow that forecasts what's going on, but it doesn't give the whole plot line away.
No, yeah.
And also because visually, and I'm talking graphics and colors, and these are things that I'm not centrally involved in. I mean, I looked at them, I approved colors, I saw scans, I widened things. It is almost, I mean, you know, I was in a band here collaborating on this book. I want to be very clear on that. But the timeline stuff really, really does work, because you get a sense of destiny and community about Neil Young. It's almost like they're little previews into where the book is going, but the whole plot is not given away. And
it also shows you how much you know is really going on in these different periods of his career. And you know, certainly, I think a lot of us feel like, you know, his career has you know sort of hyper accelerated, you know, here in the 21st century relative to, say, you know, the 80s period. Or
I mean,
like
listen, I don't know this character. There's been a few fleeting meetings and hi, how are you every once a decade for four decades, and I've only seen about, I don't know, 10 or 12 Neil Young shows. So don't count me as some kind of guy that's going to drive more than 40 miles to see him, except I did go to the Last Waltz, which is 450 miles from where I live. But that being said,
well worth the trip, I'm sure.
Well, it was one of those things. I was writing for Melody Maker magazine at the time, and they let the writers buy tickets. I think they were only $25, and you also got we got to buy I would never say they were VIP. That's not the word. The writers got to buy tickets and were escorted in to a really good section up front, where we also had turkey dinner as well.
Because it was Thanksgiving Day.
Yeah. And so that was the best $25 I ever spent, including I think I didn't even fly up there. I think I drove in a van with some people. Yeah, I do. I now remember. But we stayed at the Miyako. Yeah, I remember that. I ran into Levon Helm, you know, in the Miyako Hotel, and that was kind of cool. Wow, how you doing, Levon? How you doing, son? And he stuck his hand out, and I said, you know, I can go home right now. I just met Levon Helm. That really stuck on me. I mean. But I also have to say, before the Last Waltz, I had conducted a long interview with Robbie Robertson for Crawdaddy magazine. And so I was sort of inner sanctum, or Ray Manzarek would say the sanctum sanctorum. So I'm writing a cover story on Robbie Robertson of the band for Crawdaddy. I was allowed to buy a ticket and sort of have band seats for you know, for the Last Waltz, and take a hotel room where everybody was kind of staying. And so it isn't like, well, I'm glad I met Levon. I just spent 3 hours at Robbie, and okay, I'm not going to see what the Last Waltz about. I mean, it was in a very interesting seat of privilege of talking to Robbie Robertson before he did The Last Waltz. I seem to remember that was the chronology. And then I asked him, and then I interviewed him a second time after The Last Waltz. That's what that was, too. And it's ended up in my books and stuff like that. So I went to The Last Waltz. I'm in the movie during the scene.
Sort of part of a musical history there with The Last Waltz.
Well, I didn't know what I was going to see. Like, well, we're going to have all our friends there, and you're going to really dig it. And are you going to have blues people there? Oh, Muddy Waters is going to be there. I don't want to tell you too much about it, you know. And I went, and to me, it was pretty interesting, just because I'm in the movie, I'm in the scene where the band sings Baby Don't You Do It, because people come up to me and say, was that, you know, years later I'm dealing with this, is that you in the band movie? You had a beard then. I go, yeah, that was me. Well, what were you doing there? Were you a fan? I said, well, you know, maybe I was interviewing Jerry Garcia and Bill Graham around the same time too. I was working. I don't think people got it at the time. And so those kind of events, seeing The Last Waltz or interviewing Jerry Garcia or Bill Graham, 40 years later are in my books, are in my lectures, are in my interviews, are in my slideshows. I'm carrying all this stuff with me, and now they're finding a home in some really good books.
Yeah,
but
well,
The Last Waltz was really good because I thought that was a very stunning version of Helpless that Neil Young did that night. The guy looked like he looked like a tired person who was really weak and vulnerable, and the tempo of the tune was a little slow, and it was a very stunning moment. And then I went to the premiere of The Last Waltz at the Cinerama Dome in Hollywood, I remember. And so it was one of those things where I saw something, and then I got to go to the premiere and meet most of the principals. And I mean, that's part of what I do as Harvey Kubernick. I mean, I don't take any of this stuff for granted. I'm privileged. I'm honored. I'm here to be the messenger. But I also know I'm also passing and gifting my experience down to other people, like, you know, your devoted throng. And I know you guys dig all this stuff because you guys, you know, we're all part of the same kind of tribe of music or rock and roll or something.
Well, we go by Rusties, I think you should know. Harvey, I mean, I think, you know, you've shared a lot of great stories, and it sounds like you've crossed paths with a lot of history along the way, and it's a wonderful book that we can, you know, recommend to folks. And why don't we you know, move towards wrapping it up, and I'll just ask you, you know, if you were to try and sort of like summarize Neil Young's career or his place in rock music or how he fits into, you know, your maybe musical life, you know, just sort of, you know, maybe kind of come up with some sort of a statement on that, Neil Young and his music.
Me personally, I was in the fan club till Trans. Okay?
Okay.
I was a card-carrying member of the Neil Young fan club till Trans.
Well, you were with a lot of other folks.
and I will say, I really enjoyed a video I saw of the Trans tour with, you know, Bruce Palmer and Nils Lofgren, and some of those songs worked better live. And I wish Neil Young would have been more accessible as an interview subject at the time and explained to us the use of the vocoder on that album and part of it in the link to, you know, trying to communicate with his son and all that. I think if I would have known some of those details, I would have embraced that album a bit more. So I was a card-carrying member from 66 to the early 80s with Neil Young. Not, you know, would buy the albums, and if he played the Forum or came to town or played the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion or the Santa Monica Civic, you know, I'd buy a ticket and go. Most of the time it was as a paying customer. It wasn't as a media person. So I left the fan club for a long time. I would check stuff out, and I really, and then it's funny, it took Neil's own archive label, you know, the things that he does, like Massey Hall or the Crazy Horse, you know, Fillmore album. When he started releasing these things on his own label, I was kind of brought back in to go check out Neil Young little items that I had missed over the years. And so I'm not going to say I rediscovered him and I went out and bought 25 albums or all that kind of stuff, but there's not a picture of Neil Young on the wall where I live. But I now that I'm, and look at the whole 50-year journey of this character and see the drive and determination and the mindset, and we've all had to go through struggles, emotional, physical, medical. The word impressed is not the word I'm thinking of. And I wouldn't even want to say it's a medical marvel. It's not that deep. But I think we should celebrate and it should examine, you know, Neil Young at age 70, if age means nothing. But for him, this is a guy that really had to deal with some pretty interesting and really devastating childhood illnesses, whether it be polio, epilepsy, and things like that. And he didn't reinvent himself. He just, like a footballer, he just worked through some of the hand that was dealt him. And for a guy with polio and epilepsy and those kind of things, I don't want to play the divorce card. I don't believe in that it's infected him or had a big influence on his life. But I'm just talking medically. Just the fact that he becomes this guitar player and probably learned a new way of playing guitar, or, you know, his Les Paul work, you know, with the Bigsby tremolo system, or the fact that, you know, he knows tone, and he was like one of the first guys who took like old Fender Twins and, you know, amps and had them on stage and played through a little amp on stage and stuff like that. But as a guitar player, I think as somebody who was bedridden and somebody had to go to warm climates to recover, i.e. Florida from Canada, to sit there as a guitar player, and a touring machine, knowing he came from some medical obstacles, I think that's to be applauded. I think I didn't dwell on that too much in the book, and believe me, there were as a courtesy to Neil Young, I did a very nice job of not putting in romantic interest per se or girlfriend. I don't do that gig. I'd rather talk to an engineer than an ex-wife. Okay, that's my mantra. That being said, I took out a bunch of people that had some stories about Neil with epilepsy. I mean, you know, people in bands that shared the stage with him or trips to the hospital. I didn't play that card too much, just enough, because it's part of, it's available data. And so it kind of made me realize, gee, my sprained ankle this week isn't really that bad, as he had to go to a polio ward, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm very happy about his determination. And by the way, he's media savvy. He's always image building. He knows what he wants. There's some loyalty to some band members like Crazy Horse. It's actually a pretty interesting 50-year window of rock and roll, and I think he was really influenced by, you know, Bob Dylan, and especially Bob Dylan and the Hawks or the band. I think his whole vibe changed, you know, when he heard those music from Big Pink and all that kind of stuff, and I hear echoes of Roy Orbison in his work and all that, but he is an original, and right now as we look at the world in 2005, I know he just didn't hop on this environment ecology bandwagon. I mean, I remember about 15 years ago at a Wiltern show in Los Angeles, he was on stage talking about trying to eat organic food. But so if he wants to have tables and rail against people and be political and go green and care about, you know, ecology and Native American rights, you know, I'm all for it. He doesn't really hit us too much over the head with this stuff. It's part of the whole graphic of the Neil Young brand. But the thing is, he is drawing attention to some serious ecological issues that are really apparent in front of me. I don't think it dwarfs the music. And I'm glad he's playing with Willie's kids because Willie Nelson gave me a very
real.
Well, let me tell you about Willie Nelson. I want to say one thing, and maybe it ties in to Neil Young. I'm sorry to go off on this thing, but, you know, we're talking. So I went to Willie Nelson. I met Willie Nelson a bunch of years ago at a show at the Welter, and he was very accessible, and he came up to me. He said, "How can I help you?" And I said, I'd like 5 minutes of your time. I mean, really not an autograph guy or anything. And he said, "What do you need? What do you need?" And I said, "I want to thank you for always taking care of, you know, Ray Price, you know, bass player in your band. He cut one of your first songs. I want to thank you for always showing up in these Patsy Cline documentaries because she cut, you know, cut some of your songs." And but I said, "Willie, this book business that I'm kind of in, trying to get book deals and trying to get published, is kind of more pathetic than the record and music business that I've been on the fringes or occasionally allowed on campus." And I said, "It really doesn't make sense, Willie. I mean, I know I've got the talent because I'm just getting too much fan mail and too many people stopping me about articles I write in you know big magazines or Free magazines or Mojo magazine or Goldmine magazine." And I said, I don't have a literary agent and you know, but I know the stuff's connecting and I'm going to get a book out one day." And he said, "Son," I said, "so Willie, how does this game work? Because I really like the fact that you're going to be like, God, you're almost going to be 70 and you're still out there. I want to do this at 70 and 80. I saw Muddy Waters at the last waltz and he must have been like 60 on stage. I think we can do this music thing at 50, 60, maybe even 70. And he said, "Son, you've got to outlast everybody." And I think Neil Young is outlasting everybody. And if you,
you
really
know,
want to,
that's a really, you know, kind of maybe good place to kind of wrap it up here.
Well, there you go.
So, you know, Neil's getting ready to be 70, and you had the Willie Nelson thing here. So let's bring it to close here. I'll just say, you know, Harvey, really appreciate your time here.
My pleasure.
And your and the book and as we mentioned on the Thrasher's Wheat blog, we have a contest that the good folks there at the publishers, Hal Leonard and Backbeat Books, provided some copies so that we can get those out to some Rusties. I believe it's hitting the bookshelves or officially published. What date? Or
it's actually in bookstores. I mean,
okay.
Somebody came up to me in the market today and said, "Your book's at Barnes & Noble." And then they said, "Did you watch the CMAs last night?" And I said, "Yeah, as a matter of fact, I did. And Hank Williams Jr. and Eric Church did a version, 'Are You Ready for the Country?'"
All right.
And so I can't escape this Neil Young shadow.
Everywhere.
And I swear to you, in that same market, I said hello to Gary Burden, who was shopping there. Okay? So, you know, what can I say? The Rusty people would dig what I'm doing, okay?
Oh, yeah. Totally.
Anyways, I thank you for your time today.
Yeah.
The book is out, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all bookstores. It's out in four or six different global publishers, Hardy Grant in Australia, Omnibus in England, you know things like that. Obviously, Hal Leonard, Backbeat Books in America, and Monty Publishing in Canada. So they have there's some different covers involved per market, but it's the same book.
Very good. All right. Well, very good. So we're wrapping up here with Harvey Kubernick and his new book, Neil Young, Heart of Gold. So check it out or enter the contest there at Thrasher's Wheat. Thanks a lot, Harvey, and keep on rocking in the free world.
All for it. Thank you.